This episode is brought to you by High Ground Gaming Peripherals, elevating gamers and creators everywhere. Visit highground.co to see their latest gear and use the code 4thcurtain10 for a 10% discount.
Well, you know, Minecraft kind of changed the world in quite a few ways. One of the big ways is that you don't need the most modern in graphics, high-end graphics, to have a successful game. So, you know, now, in the last 5 years especially, there's just been this huge movement of retro-style games, which might secretly be code for we're not going to put a lot of money in our graphics. And so, you know, we're all of our games are basically retro-style games also. You know, they're pixel-based games, or they're like, we released a game called Turbo Overkill, which is has a very much a retro look to it. You know, low-polygon enemies and models and so on, and lower resolution textures and so on, but it doesn't seem to be hurting the game. People see this now as a stylistic choice, an aesthetic that they really dig. It kind of, you know, very nostalgic, and there's just a ton of these sort of retro style games coming out now. A lot of them are doing really well, and that's definitely the bandwagon we're currently riding.
That, everyone, was Scott Miller, the founder of Apogee Games, talking about how retro's having a moment, a nice aesthetic moment.
It's a different really phase of retro. Different phase of retro.
Okay. What does that mean? Different phase.
So, well, yeah, because like it started with like 8-bit, then it went to 16-bit, right? Like in the real world. Or was it 4-bit, 8-bit, 16, 32? Then around 16, it went to 3D.
3D.
Right, like Lara Croft, you know, triangle body parts, you know? Right?
What are you like trying to say?
I'm trying to say that there has been
body parts on Lara
Croft. You know what I'm talking about. But if you keep going, like graphics now, then you have normal maps, right? So they chose, there is like... You know what I'm saying? It's like car design. Like if you go back and you look at cars, right? It's like a horse and carriage. Then the Ford Model One? Is that what it's called?
Model T, wasn't it?
Yeah. Is it? I don't know. And then it just like kind of like the like Iron Man suits.
Yeah.
Like okay. Iron Man suits. They keep getting so
look, I know what you're talking about, but I'm not sure if your analogy is really holding.
I think it's really good because Turbo Overkill, listen, Turbo Overkill is like Quake level graphics, like just above Quake, right? And Quake.
Okay. And you call that a boomer shooter.
Yeah. I didn't know until we started interviewing folks. I think a few people like John Romero said it. I think he said it, Scott. He doesn't say it in the call, but I think he says it. After we hung up, like after the recording stopped, I think he mentioned
it. I know we were
because I had never heard it.
We have to try to find the phrase boomer shooter. We couldn't find it, but we know we talked about it. But yeah. Okay. All right. Well, so we do have Scott Miller today. Very excited to share that conversation. For those of you that don't know, Scott kind of invented the share. He doesn't take credit for inventing it, but he did. He pretty much invented the shareware model.
It was the best. It was the only way to get cool games. I remember.
Yeah.
As a kid.
And so. Aaron, what do you got going on right now? What do you got going on? What's happening?
Let's see. Planning.
I'll tell you
GDC.
What. Were you playing anything right now? I'm going to download Cocoon and play that over there.
Yeah, that game is gold. Dude, that game is so good. It's a really good game. It's going to. Every time you see it, like, you know, like when it's the kind of game that it feels kind of stagnant, you know? And then you play something like that and it reminds you of how creative people can be.
This thing that we do is actually a craft.
Yeah, it's a craft. Yeah, you can see the craftsmanship in there. You can see the like just the quality, the thinking, the like it really
the
sucks
care.
You in.
Yeah, the care. Excited about it. Excited. Okay. All right. What else is happening? Super Bowl is happening this weekend. You gonna watch it?
I'm not gonna watch it, no.
Really? You don't even watch them for the funny commercials?
You can watch those on YouTube afterwards.
Here's my prediction. It's going to be the most watched Super Bowl in history. And it's going
marriage.
To be...
Marriage.
What? Marriage?
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's going to be a lot of conversation about Taylor Swift.
That's what I was going to say. What if they get engaged?
That's what I was saying.
What if Travis Kelce catches the game-winning touchdown pass, and he spikes the ball, gets down on a knee, and pulls a ring out?
Yeah, or he cuts it open with a knife, or he bites it. And then he pulls a ring out. Yeah.
That's what I saw in my circles,
that there's the NFL is scripted. It's pretty funny.
Oh, that's definitely a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, it is a conspiracy theory.
This has all been designed.
Yeah, all designed. Kind of keeps the peasants in check.
Fucking genius. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
They think NASCAR is also scripted. Like WWE, WWF.
The wrestling, I believe it's called.
What's that?
Right.
Professional wrestling, that's real. That's pretty real. Yeah. I saw Geraldo get punched. He's like, "Is this a real slap?" And then he slaps Geraldo. Have you seen that video?
It's real. I don't know if I've seen it, but
wrestling is real, dude.
But I imagine that if somebody was given permission to
slap
let loose on Geraldo Rivera, they would just do it. You know, yeah, they would just do it.
Other than that, okay, I'm planning for GDC. That's what I'm doing. I'm excited about that. And we have something special for that coming up, which I'm really looking forward to.
It's going to be fun.
Which is exciting. Yeah.
Okay. A little tease happening right there. all right. Well, thank you for joining us again this week. And I hope you enjoy our conversation with Scott Miller, who is bringing retro back.
Boomer shoes.
Yes.
Which is the funniest word. It's not even offensive. Do you get offended whenever people call you boomer?
Nobody calls me boomer.
I call you boomer all the time.
That's not true. My kids, they don't do it anymore, but there was a while they're like, whatever, boomer.
Yeah. Is that like
I pulled the car over. I said, you can just walk, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Boomer's got the car keys. Yeah. All right. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Scott Miller, and we shall see you on the other side.
Leveling up your game dev career but not sure where to start?
Maybe you're trying to break into the industry, looking to connect with other people who are making games.
Consider joining the International Game Developers Association, the IGDA, the world's largest nonprofit, member-driven professional association serving all individuals who create games.
I was in the IGDA in Chicago, met a lot of people, great way to network.
The IGDA exists to support and empower game developers around the world in achieving fulfilling and sustainable careers.
Discounts,
educational and advocacy-based resources,
mentorship,
and solidarity across 160-plus chapters.
To join the IGDA, visit igda.org/membership and use the code IGDA4CURTAIN15, no spaces there,
to get 15% off 1 and 2 year memberships, as well as a student membership.
Joining the IGDA is a great move for your career, and as a nonprofit supporting everyone making games, it's a great move for the whole community. Join today. All right. Welcome to the Fourth Curtain Podcast, friends. Today, we are so lucky to have Scott Miller with us. Scott, I've never told you this. I think if it weren't for you, I would not have had a career in video games. So thank you. Call of Duty. I know. You see, everybody, Scott's the founder of Apogee and 3D Realms and pretty much invented, actually, I should take the pretty much out. You invented shareware, right? Is that fair to say?
Not fair at all. No, no.
I mean, not fair. Okay.
Was around. Take it, Scott. Take it. Take it, Scott.
I should, but no, I'm not though. But I mean, it was around for several years before I came along. No one in games was making any money. There was a few attempts to release some games under the shareware banner, but they weren't really doing very well because people were releasing the full game. And I even tried it a couple of times and it didn't work out. So it wasn't until I figured out, you know, maybe I shouldn't give away the whole thing. Maybe I should just give away like a third of it.
Okay.
So now it was sort of the breakthrough that that I came up with. It was just, you know, holding a bunch of it back, giving away a third, kind of a big taste of the game. And then at the end of that third saying, hey, if you like this, guess what? There's more. Send me a check.
Okay. All right. I think that, you know, when I, think of shareware, that I do think of that model where it's, you know, try before you buy, basically.
Duke Nukem.
So actually, you did that with Wolfenstein, Max Payne, and Prey as well as Duke Nukem. Is that right? You were doing shareware, that model, with all of those games?
I don't think we did it with Prey, which came out in 2006, but every single game before that, including Max Payne, which came out in 2001, we did sell a shareware version where people could actually order directly from us. Or, you know, like in the case of Max Payne, you know, they could just go to the store and buy it too. But we hung on to the shareware distribution rights when we did the deal with Take-Two. So, we were selling it directly ourselves. Remember that first day, we were up all night packing up, I would say, 10 to 15,000 games that had been pre-ordered from us for shareware. And honestly, by that time, the shareware end of things wasn't really that big of a deal. From a money-making perspective, we like to build our customer base up in terms of, you know, getting customer address information and all that kind of stuff. But when it came to Prey, we decided, you know, 98% of our money's coming from retail now. Let's just forget about the shareware side of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, give me a sense. What were things like back in, when was Wolfenstein? Was that like
92.
90? That was 92.
92.
What were things like in your world back in 1992? Were you in Dallas?
Yes, still here. I've been here ever since. I mean, the whole time.
Hey, Texas, baby. All right. I'm in Texas, too. Sorry, it's very rare. So when it happens, it's like, hey.
What do you mean it's rare? Texas is a pretty big place.
Yeah, but with the people we've had on, we've had like three. Sorry, Scott. Go ahead. So you're in Dallas.
Yeah, you talked to Randy. He's here, right?
Yeah.
That's
one,
right.
One of... three. Yeah.
Patrick. So, I mean, what was it like back then? I mean, you know, the whole industry for us was still really new. Apogee had only been around for a couple of years. You know, we'd had a bit of a couple of hits with Commander Keen and our first Duke Nukem game. But, you know, Wolfenstein just took it to a whole, you know, tenfold new level. And it just blew up. I mean, we kind of figured we were onto something, but the way it blew up just caught everyone by surprise, including id Software. You know, that was the time that they were all starting to buy their Ferraris and everything.
So what do you think that was? Do you think it was the mixture of it being like a first-person shooter, which a lot of people hadn't really seen at the time, and the shareware model? Or
honestly, it would have probably done better as a retail game. Because back then there was a lot of friction for people to send us a check or call our 800 number, you know, and somehow make that work. You know, it wasn't like now on Steam, you just, you know, get on there and click a buy button or something. So it took a lot of friction for people to order from us. So I've always kind of estimated that, in general, for every 100 people that played one of our shareware games back then, one or two people sent us a check or bought the game from us. So it was not that great of a conversion rate, but because the shareware version got out to literally millions and millions and millions of people, you know, even a 1% conversion rate turned into pretty good numbers.
Hmm. Yeah.
Like the free-to-play model.
I know. It's like, it's sort of kind of come back around with how free-to-play works. Well, large numbers, I suppose. But all right. So back in the 90s, how like far out of school were you, and actually did you go to school? Like, what was your upbringing like?
Yeah, I dropped out of college my last semester.
Nice.
because I was getting a computer science degree and thought I'd somehow, you know, end up in the computer business in some way or fashion. But I had started experimenting with the shareware model on my own with some games I called Kingdom Across and whatever, and these were my first successful shareware games. And for about a year, in my last year of college, for about a year, there these Cross games, which are just, you know, ASCII-based little, it was like a little rogue-style game, nothing to it at all, but it was making about $150,000 that year. And I realized, yeah, you know, I realized that it wasn't necessarily the game. I mean, the game was okay, but it was the shareware marketing technique. And I thought, you know, I'm really onto something here. I'm just going to drop out of school and see if I can turn this into a full-time company. And I did that my last semester. And, of course, all my friends said I was crazy. But, you know, within 6 months, they're all working for me. So
nice. What were you studying? What was your major?
It was computer science.
Computer science.
Oh, I missed that. Did you write those games? Those first games? Were you programming them?
Yeah, they were all done in Borland's Turbo Pascal.
Hey, I know.
Oh, yeah.
That was my language.
Yeah. Funny. But yeah, early Mac programming was Pascal. I wrote a lot of Pascal.
Oh, I love Pascal. Cool. Yeah, I would go back to this day if I could. But anyway.
I haven't seen it around. I don't know that it really exists anymore.
This is what they taught us in high school.
It was our high school
programming language.
What did your parents have an opinion on you dropping out? You're like right before your
degree? My parents also ended up working for me. So I mean,
this guy's like a mocha. You can't see, folks, but he has gold teeth right now. Sorry, go ahead, Scott.
My mom, she was really my first employee. My dad, he was still working for, I think, Raytheon. He used to work at NASA and then he got hired by Raytheon.
Oh, Raytheon.
He was working on some high tech, military.
Yeah.
But during the night, he was kind of our database manager. He was putting together some sort of database program so we could, take all the orders properly, inventory everything. And he was working on this for months and months and months. And then I had even my brother and my sister were working for us at one point. Order processing was a big deal. Order taking. Very quickly we get up to like 10 or 12 order takers, full-time manning the phone, the 800 number, then people had to process orders. So, it wasn't until we were selling Wolfstein for about a year that we decided to outsource all that stuff because it was just getting too big for us.
Yeah.
And then I ended up firing my mom and then firing my dad. So,
oh no, but it brings me back because, we like at Bungie, we started in, early 90s, and we were taking orders too. And I never really thought about it like until this very conversation, but like it was so different back then. It was kind of, did you ever do any assembly language programming?
No.
But when you're like doing assembly language programming, it's like you know exactly like where the memory is and where it's moving from this register to that register. It's like exactly what's going on inside the machine. And when you're running your own business where you're talking to the customer and you're almost like retail, you're taking their money and you're putting their thing in a box and shipping it to them. It's sort of like that. It's like it's as raw. And today it's so far away from that.
The bank.
No, and when the great thing is that, people who send us checks, and a ton of people send us checks, so often they would also include like a little letter in there saying how much they love the game and this and that, and their kid loved it or this,
That's cool.
And so all of these personal letters were coming in too. And a lot of them I actually responded to. So that took a lot of time back in the day, but eventually it got to the point where I couldn't do it. And I had my mom help out with that and stuff. And, but it was just so great back in those days, seeing the personal messages that came along, people just, everyone had like a little story to tell about how much they loved your game, how they found it, or, what enjoyment they got out of it and so on.
Yeah. Yeah. I miss that. Today, if everybody could just hide behind anonymous internet comments and they say all sorts of horrible things, but back then.
Some nice stuff too.
You're going to put a piece of pen on a piece of paper. It's usually because you have something constructive to say. So that's pretty awesome.
So how many games did you have when you were doing this? I'm assuming the letters came from people that were buying the sequels and stuff, right?
They were buying the extra episodes that we would sell. Like for Wolfenstein, we had one episode out there for free. That was 10 levels. And then we had another 50 levels or 5 more episodes you could buy. And on that game there, so we started off, we were doing the typical trilogy thing. And then I said to Tom Tom Hall and John Romero, I said, look, guys, I think this is going to be big. It doesn't take you that long to make a level. It took them like a day and a half to make a whole level. I said, what if we had another 3 episodes as another upsell item so that, the plan was we'll sell the first trilogy for $35, or you can get this other trilogy also for $50 total. And then we even had a hint book for $10 more. And guess what? At least 95% of the people bought that whole thing. They got the whole upsell, so it totally paid off. So yeah, there was like 60 levels that you could get with that original game you bought from us.
Wow.
And what about the original stuff? The Kingdom's Cross, you called? What was that?
Kingdom of Cross. I mean, how many of those games? I had seven of those at one point, but they quickly got eclipsed by the Commander Keys, the Duke Nukem's, Cosmos Cosmic Adventure, Raptor, Wolfenstein, Duke Nukem 2, and Rise of the Triad. And I mean, I'm just kind of going up the ladder of all the games that are released, but those original games just kind of fell off the map for us.
Yeah. I mean, that stretch you just sort of describing right there really was the foundation of what we call core gaming today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
I had all the shareware of those games.
Well, yeah. Did you have any idea that this sort of genre was like, what was your, like, who ended up being your first competitors, I guess?
There was a couple of companies back then. There was one called MVP Software. I think it was run by Dave Sharpless, and he was always trying to come out with something that would compete with us. And I would meet these people at, there was like an annual shareware convention that we would go to back in 91, 92, 93, 94, and then we stopped going. But so I would end up meeting some of these people. Of course, there was Tim Sweeney. He was writing me letters as early as January 1991, and he was showing me his ZZT game and asking for advice, and I was sending him letters. I've got all these letters still. I even post them on my Twitter now and then. But we were going back and forth with all these letters, and I also found out that behind the scenes, he was doing private little like newsletters to his core developers he was working with, giving him inside stuff like, here's what Scott Miller and Apogee are up to, and we need to do this too. And kind of a little espionage
stuff. He was a spy.
The way I saw it, we were always friends back then. I was friendly with everyone back then. And of course, there was Ed Software, who we worked with the first two Commander Keen trilogies, and then Wolfenstein. And then, of course, they went off and did Doom and Quake and everything on their own. But, we all still remained friends. We were still in Dallas. I was just in Ireland a couple of weeks ago, had great dinner and fun time with John and his wife, Brenda Romero. So everyone's still friends from those days. And, because we all kind of grew up during the same era, shared the same experiences, kind of shared the same path of success and everything. We're basically all old timers now too, but we're still involved with the industry and still having fun. I don't ever see really leaving.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is something I'm kind of curious about. So that's a full career, and you're still working in it. Like, what does it for you? Like, what keeps you excited about games in the game industry?
I mean, I just love working with all the talented people. What Apogee does nowadays is kind of what we did in the 90s. We try and find, hidden gem upstart studios that that we can partner with and help them make the best version of their game. And so that's what we're doing. And we currently have 10 or 11 games that we're working on developing and publishing with partners, with teams all around the world. And it's really the same feeling as it was in the 90s. We're just looking for super talented people with games that have something innovative and unique about them. It's just fun. Really the same feeling as in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. We're starting to make games on like UGC platforms, which is, it's kind of like small scale compared to big AAA stuff, but it's got that same vibe, it's like super fast, super, super creative, I love that. Are you working with any of the same developers that you used to know, or is it all a whole new crop of talent?
A lot of the people are from back then. We're not working with them in a developer role necessarily, but they're working with us as like producers, helping these younger teams, manage their projects and stay on schedule and meet milestones and follow the roadmap and all that kind of stuff. So, they're bringing their experience to the table now in that respect. So there's about six of us now that are from the 90s that are still here. Just bringing a lot of experience to the table.
Cool. And is the distribution all on is it through Steam? Is it on your own? Is it PC focused?
Yeah, everything's being first developed on the PC. It's all going through Steam. We released a couple of games. Our first two games came out since we relaunched Apogee 2 years ago. Our first two games came out in the last 6 months, and we're working on ports for those. They're going to appear on all the consoles, and we expect those ports to come out in the first quarter of next year. So that's kind of our plan, you know, PC first, and then from there, you know, get the ports done. Yeah, but we're not doing anything like we did in the 90s in terms of direct selling. You know, it's all digital platforms now.
Yeah, yeah. Is it all paid download, or is you doing any free to play? What do you think of free to play?
Yeah, for us, no plans for free to play right now. I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but it would take the right team to come along. What do I think about it? I mean, it can be done well. I'm not a fan of, you know, in any way paying to like improve your standing in the game, improve your power level or whatever. If you want me to pay for like more levels, I'm cool with that. I just don't like the idea that it's like a shortcut to grinding. You know, basically a lot of these games are grind fest unless you pay to take shortcuts, to skip a lot of the grinding. That I'm not necessarily a fan of.
So are the games you're making now, are they like standalone story, no multiplayer type thing? Or is multiplayer, it's peer-to-peer type thing?
Yeah, yeah. Most of them do have multiplayer. Our first two have multiplayer. But it's just built into the cost. I mean, these are just, you know, one-time payment games, and you get the full package.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. If we rewind the clock a little bit and we go back to post-Wolfenstein, how many years between Wolfenstein and Max Payne were there? There was a few years in there, right?
Yeah, that was 9 years.
9 years. So in that time frame, I got to imagine you're probably getting a lot of pitches from developers to publish their game. Any good stories from that time period of ones either that got away or or ones that got away that should have?
Nukem Infinite.
I mean, there was a couple that got away, like the guys that made Descent. So we actually made a deal with those guys. It was Parallax Software with Matt Toshlog and Mike Kolos. I want to say I might be getting that wrong.
I think that's right.
So they had this great pitch for us. This whole Six Degrees of Freedom space combat or something game. Flew them down to Apogee. I remember they were fans of Bruce Lee, and that new movie Dragon had just come out. So me, George, and them went to George was my partner at the time. We went to see Dragon at the theaters with them. We went over to Id's offices and had them talk to John Carmack for a couple hours and kind of pick each other's brains and so on. And we did a publishing deal with those guys, and they had a pretty high burn rate at the time. I remember it was like $18,000 a month, and this was in 1993. And about a year into it, they came to us and said, you know, this is a bigger project than we thought. Kind of need to double the burn rate. And we were like, no, we had just kind of laid the groundwork for four of our build engine games. The build engine is what we used to make Duke Nukem 3D and Shadow Warrior. Blood was one of the games. So we had a full plate of these higher budget games ourselves on the table. And I was like, you know, I don't know if we can handle this. You know, it would have been almost a 40K budget for these guys a month. So we ended up selling the rights to Interplay. And so that's kind of one that got away. And, you know, of course, Descent did pretty well. What else? I don't know if there was.
I remember Descent. Descent, so they were in Champaign, Illinois, one of the few developers down there. And we were in Chicago, and I remember going down there to visit those guys. And I was blown away by the game. I'm kind of quick to motion sick. And that one in particular really got me, you know, because it's got so much, you could spin yourself around and everything.
It's like cave diving when you're playing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you're basically in these tunnels, and it can be claustrophobic and confusing and disorienting. Yeah, yeah, definitely. A couple others that I wouldn't say got away, but before before the Matrix movie ever came out or I heard anything about it, we got a call from someone saying, we represent this this property, and we want to see if your studio would be interested in doing a game based on it. And it was the Matrix.
What?
And they didn't talk about anything about slow motion or anything. They just basically said, you know, it's this guy who lives in this computer world and stuff. And to me, it sounded kind of hokey. And we kind of, the whole time back then, we were like, you know, we can make our own IPs. I don't want to ever like work on someone else's IP and not be able to own it and control it and, you know, do something with it in the future. So we just kind of automatically just turned down anything like that. So we turned down the Matrix. I know we turned down Men in Black. That was pitched to us. And there was a couple others that might come to me, but those are the two big ones.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
But no regrets to me about that. No regrets.
Cool. Did you guys do Terminal Velocity as well? Mm-hmm. Was that you guys? And yep. Was that with, they were in Dallas too, I think, right? The developer?
Mark Randall was the lead programmer on that. The company was called Terminal Reality. And that's right.
They had their own 3D engine, because I think at Wideload, we licensed that engine too. It's crazy how all of these 3D teams, you know, have all these various connections around.
Well, Mark, when they came to us, pitched their game to us, Mark's big selling point was that he had done the most recent flight simulator engines for Microsoft's flight simulator game. So I figured, well, this guy probably knows what he's doing, so let's give him a shot.
What was it at Wideload? What was the...
Do you remember Fletcher? He was like one of the engineers on that engine. And when he came up to Chicago, we licensed the engine for, I'm trying to remember which game. It might have been Guilty Party, which would have been an odd game to use the Terminal Reality engine on. But yeah, small world.
So do you play games now? Like, are you a gamer? Would you say are you playing anything? Kind of a way left turn of what Alex was got in there. I'm just really curious. No, because I'm really curious because you said you don't eat like the free to play thing, power creep. Like, so it's like, whoa, okay. Well, then what does your personal library look like? Are you playing any free to play games? It's like,
no, but there's a couple of little puzzle games on mobile that I play. One's called King Rabbit. I've been playing that for about a year. It's just like endless user-made levels, and they're all pretty good. I haven't really been playing much on PC or console lately. The last game I finished on the console was Breath of the Wild. Love that game. I've been meaning to get into the new one, but just haven't had a chance. You know, what happens is that, you know, we've got like 10 games in development, and I play these games, play builds of these games all the time.
So you are playing games. You know, you're playing the ones you're working on. Yeah.
Right. Playing them, you know, making notes the whole time. And, you know, after, you know, a full day of that, the last thing I want to do is, you know, then go play another game. You know, but I am waiting for, you know, an action RPG to come out that, you know, because that's, that's like my favorite genre right there. Diablo 2 is probably my favorite game. And then I've been meaning to try Diablo 4, but I've been hearing mixed reactions on it. So I've been kind of holding off on that. But yeah, I mean, not much lately other than things we're making.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. So I am curious about Max Payne. I love that game. It was like super impressive visually. And it wasn't just like a gimmick, you know, it was like a real, like that whole mechanic was like a real game mechanic.
That mechanic's awesome.
Yeah. How did that game come to you guys? How did that all happen?
Well, we first started working with that team on a game called High Speed, which we then renamed to Death Rally. And we released that in 1996. And they had a team of about five or six people, and we worked together on that game for about 8 or 9 months, and we just had a great relationship with them. And so afterwards, I told the team, I said, you know, we should definitely work again. Why don't you come up with a couple of pitches, and we'll pick a pitch that makes sense. And so a few months later, they came back with three pitches. One of them was kind of a homeworld style game, One of them was some sort of racing game, and one of them was a top-down detective game. And I said, you know, I'm not really that big on any of these, although I like the story of the detective game. So maybe let's talk more about that. And I said, you know, I think that we can fund this. And they were at, it worked out to like a $2 million budget. I said, we can fund this if we instead go full 3D, because that's where, you know, that's where the world's at now. We don't want to do, you know, this top down 3D. It was going to be kind of like an Interplay loaded style game, I think they were trying to pitch to us. I think they were calling it Dark Justice. I said, let's do it. Let's do full 3D. We had just started work on Duke Nukem Forever. And I said that we're going to take the approach of using only photo sourced textures for Duke Nukem Forever. I said, I think that that would also work well for this game. So they agreed to that idea. And I said, I had a few other ideas, but anyway, so they came back with another pitch. Oh, and I said, let's not name it Dark Justice. You know, let's do like we do with Duke Nukem and create a character. You know, if we do this right, it might, you know, turn into a movie or who knows what, you know. So it's I always like the idea of comic books that they, you know, comic books are named after the lead character, you know, Spider-Man, Superman, you know, Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. So let's come up with a great character name. And so it just kind of snowballed from there. And the whole idea of bullet time was never in the game from the start. One of the ideas that was in the game kind of from the start was this John Woo slow motion coolness. You know, they were like, let's make this sort of John Woo inspired. And so about a year and a half into development, I was over in Finland where their offices were, and they were at about 15 people at that point. And they were showing me the John Woo stuff, and the John Woo stuff worked like this. You would dart into a room, you would shoot, let's say there was three or four bad guys in there. When you killed the last bad guy, then the game would go into the slow motion mode and the camera would swing around the last dying bad guy as he was like falling to the ground in slow motion, this cool way. Then it would come back to you. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. This is absolutely brilliant. I love it. And I said, it's so cool. We need to find a way to make this part of gameplay. And so I came home like a couple of days later and I was thinking about how to do this. And I remember writing down a piece of paper and I posted this on my Twitter where I first had the idea for bullet time. I basically said, what if Max Payne can activate bullet time and the whole game drops into the slow motion mode, but here's the key. This is the key that makes bullet time work, is that his aiming is still at real time speed. That's really the key gimmick to bullet time, is that yes, everything drops in slow motion, but you can still aim at normal speed.
That's cool. I didn't even think about that.
That's what makes it fun. That's what makes it fun. Didn't have a name for it yet. Didn't have the bullet time name for it yet. That came along a few months later. But so they implemented this and we tried it and it was just, everyone just loved it. And so, yeah, but it wasn't an idea that was originally in the game.
Did you patent it?
I don't think there's a way
to patent.
I don't think they something like that. But no, we never even thought about that.
The little arrow in Crazy Taxi was patented, I think, right?
That was patented?
I think so. And then like playing a game before while it's loading. Well, I'm asking because everybody copied that bullet time. It's like Fear had it. Like 20 games came out later that had that mechanic totally ripped off, yeah.
And we had the bullet time name before the Matrix movie even came out. And a lot of people don't realize, but bullet time isn't even a phrase used in the Matrix. So a lot of people think that we stole it from the Matrix, but no, we didn't. In fact, who released the Matrix? Was it Warner or Fox? I can't remember who, but they tried to.
Fox.
I think it was Fox. They tried to do some sort of legal.
Warner. It was Warner. Yeah.
They tried to do some sort of legal thing with us, and we fairly easily kind of showed them that, no, we own the rights to this. We had the name first before you ever had the Matrix or whatever, and they just backed right off.
Huh. Wow. That's crazy. That's crazy. I love that. I love that story about how, you know, you kind of came to the element of that idea that makes it fun. To me, that's like pure game design right there. You know, it's like this something that sounds good in theory, but then when you actually implement it, there's these tiny little decisions that have such a big impact on how something feels or plays.
Yeah.
And I think that's a super cool example. And also, like, how crazy is it that they came and pitched you the Matrix movie before it was a Matrix movie?
Yeah, what was the timeline there? What was the timeline? Did Max Payne, like, did they pitch it to you after Max Payne or before?
It was definitely before. I think they pitched it to us, I want to say, at least 18 months to 20 months before the movie came out. I don't even remember when the movie came out. Was it 1999?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Could be. It was before that, I think, because I was still in Chicago. Because I remember seeing it at McClure Court. Yeah,
that's where I saw it.
Must have been right around there. Yeah. Yeah. What kinds of, like, kind of culture stuff are you into that's been sort of informative in the way you look at games and that kind of thing, like movies, books, that sort of stuff? What are you into?
Just all the standard nerdy stuff. Star Trek, Star Wars, you know, big Marvel fan, all that stuff. But I'm a very sort of voracious reader. I try and read 50 to 80 books a year. Almost all nonfiction. You know, I've always got audiobooks going in my car, and reading books. So I just love learning, and I feel like the more I know, the more I can tie different things together, you know, in unique ways and stuff. So I just read about any topic, you know, even topics, you know, I'm not a wine drinker, but I like reading about versus how wine is made and the whole vineyard process and the whole history of wine. And, you know, so I'll just take deep dives into any of these topics and read books about them and so on. Big science nerd, you know, love anything to do with quantum physics or relativity or the cosmos or black holes or any of that kind of fun stuff. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. What are you on now?
I love that.
What's the deep dive right now?
I just finished a book called it was the book by a guy who was collaborating with Stephen Hawking's, his last theory about time and the value, how the universe came to be and stuff. Pretty interesting stuff.
Cool. Huh. Have you read anything about quantum computing? Because I hear stuff about how quantum computers are gonna revolutionize and probably destroy the universe, but it doesn't make any sense to me. It's like,
yeah, I don't know,
answers at the same time or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's totally an area I haven't read much about. You know, I'm just waiting for the tech to be, you know, in a PC at some point. You know, then I'll start learning about it. But
okay.
Oh, we got to talk about AI with this guy now.
I'm what not much about AI.
No,
I don't really know much about AI either.
Really? You're not going to sound like ChatGPT or anything like that?
Never. I've got some friends who are into it a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I've actually experimented a little bit here and there. It hasn't seemed to be helpful to me yet. So, but.
That's fair.
Okay. Well, so really interesting to hear about your direction to the, that was Remedy, right? That did the original Max Payne.
Mm-hmm.
Because you brought up Duke Nukem, how did Duke Nukem kind of get started, and like that character and such a huge character, you know, get created and all that?
Sure. I mean, that was a coder that I started working with in 1990. His name was Cawdry Pogel. Started working with him on a couple other games first, and then I think Duke Nukem became the fourth game that we worked together with. And he was working on a game that was just, you know, this sort of badass sort of 80s action hero kind of a guy. And he was calling the game Heavy Metal. And I said, no, Todd, let's give it a character name. You know, once again, you know, that talk again. And I came up with the Duke part. And he came up with the Nukem part. And it just fit together. Didn't make any sense, but it fit together. So we just rolled with it. And it was just a little platforming game, you know, that we released in, I think, late 1991. Then we did a Duke Nukem 2, another, well, he did Cosmic Convention next. Then we did another Duke Nukem game, Duke Nukem 2. And then, you know, the Duke Nukem games proved to be both very successful, even as platforming games. And so we had this build engine come along, and we knew that that was the future. And Todd started to learn how to use it and everything. And it was like, well, let's just do a third Duke Nukem game and use doing the build engine. And that became Duke Nukem 3D. That game
is awesome.
Oh, thanks. That game is the game we decided.
We were just talking before you got on. Aaron was saying how the first level of Duke Nukem 3D is the his. What you say it, Aaron?
I think it's one
level
of the
level ever.
Especially for shareware, you could just play multiplayer on there. Like you gave away the best level, of the game for free. It was awesome. So we would just play the shareware version. It was so good.
Yeah, it was a great multiplayer level, no doubt about it. Little secret areas and passageways and stuff.
Yeah.
But Duke Nukem really didn't become, each game kind of further defined his character. And the fact that we figured out we could add voice to Duke Nukem 3D, which all kind of happened in the last 6 months of the game.
Dude, it was the best. That's what made it. I'm all out of bubblegum, right? Like kick ass. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, yeah.
I was actually doing a lot.
We first only had like about 8 lines in the game. I think 4 of those lines are when you selected one of the skill levels, Duke would read the skill level. And when we heard it, it was like, oh my God, this adds so much to the game. Let's find more places to add his lines. And we ended up doing about 100 lines for that first game. And it just totally gave him personality. We gave him shades, by giving him a voice, he really developed an attitude and a personality, and it just brought him to life. And, if it weren't for that voice that we added to the game, like just little things like even, damn, I'm looking good. When he looks in the mirror, just totally speaks to his character right there. Just all the little things he said. And we loved that because, we knew that at the time, id was doing Doom and Quake. We knew that they preferred sort of like the faceless character, the idea that, let the player become the character on the screen. So a lot of the stuff we did with Duke Nukem 3D was sort of a reaction of like, id's doing it this way. Let's do it another way. They're not doing any humor in their games. Let's add humor to our games. They're not really doing interactive environments. Let's take the time to do interactive environments in our games. They're kind of like in a arbitrary space station. Let's be on Earth in recognizable locations, like in LA movie screens, just all this kind of stuff, And so a lot of what we did with Duke 3D, was a reaction of let's be different to what it's doing with Doom. Let's not come up with the exact same weapon set. Let's come up with some really crazy weapons like the Shrinker. The ice shooter, just all this kind of stuff. So it was just trying to be different. We didn't want to be seen as another one of these Doom clones. Everything back then was like a Doom clone, if you were an FPS game.
That's right.
So we try to be different.
Did you work on Shadow Warrior?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was our games too.
Yeah. That was very Doom, Duke Nukem, like had a lot of humor. Did that do okay? How did that do?
It came out like a year and a half after Duke 3D, and by that time the engine tech had sort of become a little long in the tooth. It did probably about one third of what Duke did.
It had cool weapons.
It still did great. I mean, the two lead developers.
One third of Duke must be pretty good, right? Duke was true. A pretty big hit.
Yeah,
I think Quake was out at the time too, right? Like Quake was, I think it was Quake.
I think Quake and Duke 3D kind of were almost released within a few months of each other. So a lot of magazines back then were like, Duke Nukem 3D versus Quake. And believe it or not, a lot of the magazines said Duke 3D because it just was more, they said more fun. Obviously Quake was the technical achievement. I kept all these articles and everything. And I go back and look at them and a lot of people were on the side of Duke 3D. I mean, but, looking back nowadays, why even argue? They're both great games.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Wait, where did the, I should know this. I don't. Where did the build engine come from? Did you guys make it?
We found one of these little young geniuses who was, his father was a mathematician at Brown University in New Jersey. Am I getting that right? He was like a 17-year-old little kid genius. His name was Ken Silverman, and he had released this demo called Ken's Labyrinth. And Tim Sweeney, he appeared on Tim Sweeney and Mark Rain's radar, and they did a deal to get Ken's Labyrinth but Tim was working on his own engine at the time, Unreal getting that started. So they didn't really have any further need for Ken. And I started talking to Ken, and Doom had come out, and Ken was like, yeah, I'm working on an engine that's going to be like a Doom engine. I said, well, let me see it. And so I saw it and I go, you know, this is actually really impressive. Why don't we fly you down? And he flew down with his dad. He always had to come down with his dad because he was kind of young. And we had several dinners together and talked and everything. And we ended up making a deal to where we would, pay for Ken to keep development on this build engine. And we would use it, you know, for as many games as we could. And we started off with these four games. And we even had Ken go meet Carmack one day. And Carmack later said that of all the engine developers he ever talked to, Ken was the most impressive. He just had nothing but praise for Ken. And Ken really was very impressive. At his age, 17 and 18 and 19, for him to develop this engine and the editor and everything kind of all on his own. And we used it for a whole bunch of successful games. And it's even still around nowadays.
Really?
It's being used in games like Iron Fury, which there's an Iron Fury and a sequel that just came out called Aftershock.
I'm gonna check this.
It's all part of the whole retro movement.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And so did Ken keep working with you over the years, or
after we released,
somewhere else?
Or? Yeah, after we released our build engine games, and this was around 97, 98, what did he do? I know he tried working on a full 3D engine, but at that time we decided we were going to go and license the Unreal Engine. So Ken, I think, just went back to school, finished his school, and I talked to him a few years ago when he's working for some high-tech company doing something. Can't remember exactly what, but. Yeah, he kind of went his own way. But, he made a ton of money off the build engine games, a ton of money.
That's cool.
He was getting...
I just looked up the
game. Yeah.
He was getting like...
I just looked up Ion Fury.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry. What were you going to say?
I was just saying that. No, Ken made a lot of money. So he was probably set for life just off of Duke Nukem and Shadow Warrior and those build engine games.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. And he was like 17 when you first met him?
Yep. And around 19 when the game started coming out. Yeah.
Wow. That must have been quite a trip. I guess today, that's not so unusual to have something kind of go big that young.
There's a lot of people now and like UEFN and all that are making, and Roblox.
Yeah.
like a lot of... So this, what do you think of the whole retro thing coming back? I just looked up Ion Fury, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that looks awesome. I just bought, there's a Warhammer game called Bolt Gun.
Yes.
That's also like that retro. And it's really fun playing games like that now with a really powerful PC. Because back then, to play Quake at normal settings, like very few people had the Pentium and, I'd play on like the lowest settings or whatever.
Well,
it's pretty cool.
Minecraft kind of changed the world in quite a few ways. One of the big ways is that you don't need the most modern in graphics, high-end graphics, to have a successful game. And now in the last 5 years especially, there's just been this huge movement of retro style games, which might secretly be code for, we're not going to put a lot of money in our graphics. we're all of our games are basically retro style games. Also, they're pixel based games, or they're like we released a game called Turbo Overkill, which has a very much a retro look to it. Low polygon enemies and models and so on, and lower resolution textures and so on, but it doesn't seem to be hurting the game. People see this now as a stylistic choice, an aesthetic that they really dig. It kind of, very nostalgic. And there's just a ton of these sort of retro style games coming out now. A lot of them are doing really well. And that's definitely the bandwagon we're currently riding.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that is cool. Like BattleBits, that's another example of a game that's done really well. That is has that kind of look.
It's like pixel art. It's like modern. Like the next thing is this low poly.
Do you find that gives you guys an opportunity to try different kinds of gameplay that maybe you wouldn't try if you had to bet a huge budget on?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it allows us to focus a lot more on just the gameplay side. It's not in any way that costly to redo things like models. If something's not working out right, it's not that costly to redo levels. It's not that costly to have huge levels with just all kinds of multiple mazy paths. You know, the big modern games, you know, the more extensive they are, you know, it seems like they're more on rails to a lot of extent, to where it's just so expensive to build the levels and the sets in the game. You're kind of like on one path the whole game. You know, it's too expensive to have multiple paths. But with these games, it's not that expensive at all. A game like Turbo Overkill, which is 30 levels, they're huge, they're varied, they're full of gameplay. You know, it's under a $250,000 total budget game.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and it's a first-person shooter, too.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
So that's the playground we want to stay in. The tools that are out there now make it very easy to get a game project going. The marketplace, you can buy assets if you want. You can buy code. You can you know, you don't have to always invent your own stuff, your own AI, whatever. It's just all out there now. So it's a whole different world for indie developers around the world because the cost to entry is very low. You don't have to learn a lot. You can be more artistic rather than code driven. So,
what engine is Turbo Overkill?
That's using Unity.
Unity, okay.
Yeah.
Have you thought of using the build engine again, like the Ion game, or?
Well, I was actually involved with the start of Ion Fury. It's actually using a character that Apogee created from the '90s, a character we call Bombshell. She was supposed to be a companion to Duke Nukem and Duke Nukem Forever, but when we sold Duke Nukem Forever to Gearbox, we carved out Bombshell and kept her, and now she's in her own games. I don't think we're going to be using the build engine. It's a very finicky engine, and it gives you a very specific look. So I'm sure we'll be using Unity and Unreal from going forward.
Yeah. There's so much kind of like stuff you get with those engines that just, like you're saying, help take care of things that maybe are outside the critical path of game design. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
It also makes me think of the stylistic choice too, that you're actively trying to stay low poly and, you know, whereas the build engine, it kind of forces you to stay there. It sounds like.
Yeah. You have no choice with the build engine.
But with this, you're like, well, we're actively trying to kind of like, what is those games that, those pixel RPG games that came out, like Octopath Traveler and all that, those are done in the Unreal Engine as well. And they're like, you could tell it's a style.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Style choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So between now, like, so you were saying like a couple of years ago, you relaunched Apogee. And like, what was the through line from, I'm sure there are interesting stories in there and I'm not sure what you want to tell or not.
Well, but, you know, Alex, like, wants... He wants a spice.
Well, from the Duke Nukem Forever, you know, sure, through to today.
Like, I call it Duke Nukem Infinite earlier. Yeah, Duke Nukem Forever. There's probably...
Well, I'm sure there were, like, choices and things that you had to make along that journey. I'm just curious which of those might be formative to chat about.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give a quick, super fast rundown. After Duke 3D, we wanted to do a sequel, of course. It should have only taken us 2 or 3 years, but it took forever. And by 2000, by 2010, our publisher stopped funding the game. They had lost faith in it. And we ended up doing a deal with Gearbox to finish the game. And Gearbox did the deal. And they now own the Duke Nukem property. They came out with Duke Forever. Didn't do that well. So that's, I guess, why there's not been another game since then, since 2010. But we still had 3D Realms, and I ended up selling 3D Realms to an investor in Denmark back in 2014. And so it's been, and I was working with them until a couple of years ago, up until when Embracer Group bought them out. So once that happened, I left and decided that it was time to restart Apogee and go back to our roots, sort of an indie publisher, kind of like we were in the 90s. So get some venture funding and started off the company. You know, we signed 10 or 12 games in the last, 18 months. We've already released two. We have a bunch more coming out next year. We're just like all over the map, very diverse lineup of games coming out. We've got cozy games. We've got, roguelike games. We've got first person shooters. We're just all over the map. And did I answer your question? I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think we've watched, all seen what Devolver has done with the idea of building a brand and a publishing entity around independent gaming, which I think is super cool. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you have your own sort of view on what that could be like. Do you still have like the Apogee games from back, back in the day? Are those still part of the catalog, or is it a fresh start?
We do have the rights to some of them, but back in the 90s, we never actually, the games that we signed from other developers, we never owned the rights to those games. But we have gone back to some of those authors and said, hey, we'd like to remaster some of them. So we worked out, deals to do that. So some of the old games from the 90s, we have remastered. But really, these remasters don't really do that well, so we're probably not going to be doing that anymore. We just recently remastered, working with Night Dive Studios, Rise of the Triad, and that's actually doing pretty well. But I don't think we're going to be doing any more remasters. I really want to focus on finding new IP and just bringing new IP to the market, like Turbo Overkill. We've done another game, Bread and Fred, which is around 400,000 copies sold in the last 5 months since we released it. That was a game that only cost us $50,000 to make. So
what? That's a good deal.
That's a pretty.
We're not going to ever compete with Halo or Call of Duty or anything like that. But at the indie level, there's still money to be made. And like the developers for Bread and Fred, they're set now. they're actually working on a big expansion for it. We're working on the ports for it. So, for a little team like that, it was just a 3-person team, this is going to set them up for life.
That's the dream, right?
Yeah. But they're like young 20s. They're going to keep at it. So they're going to keep making sequels and they have another idea for a whole other game they want to make. And so, for them, the fun's just getting started. They just got off to a fast start. I don't know. This is just a really fun place to be working with indie developers, very small budgets, so that, if something doesn't work out, it's not going to hurt the company. But we're pretty sure that everything we release is going to at least make its money back, which is not that hard to do with these budgets. So, and we kind of feel like everything we release can make 10 to 25 times as money as sort of a base, and hopefully more from there. But,
I gotta say, I think that's the most exciting part of the business right now, because on the other side, like the AAA side, those budgets are getting so big that there's so much fear, of getting it wrong, that it's hard to do anything new, And so
it's hard.
Exactly. And you can work with first time developers. You can work on ideas that, hey, I don't, this could work or not work, but we're going to try it. And I think that's super exciting. How do you find these developers, like that 3-person shop you're talking about, kids in their 20s, like how do you find them?
Thank you, internet. I mean, they're always posting their stuff, on Twitter or social feeds. And if you know just what feeds to look at, you'll come across them. It's like Bread and Fred, before we signed it, it had already had, there was already a demo out on Steam, and there was some TikTokers who were doing it, streamers, and they were getting like a million views for this game, because it's just a fun little co-op. game where it's like a rage game and you're laughing your ass off when you're playing against someone else and saying, why didn't you jump in? Or, you know, and you're just kind of having fun together. And I saw that and I go, I said, I immediately was obvious. This game's got some magic to it. So contacted them, offered them some money, offered them, you know, exactly what they were hoping for, looking for, and just made a deal. So these games are being advertised by the developers. You know, developers nowadays, they get the word out. You know, they're releasing videos, screenshots, or putting up a Steam page. And it's just a matter of finding, you know, for us, the games that look the most promising or exactly the kind of game that we think, you know, there's a great market spot for it or whatever. So, you know, we probably look through hundreds of games to find a couple. That's just how it works.
Huh. Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, that's cool. That sounds like a really, A, as a business person, a great business, but B, as a creative and gamer, like super fun, exciting. So good on you. I'm happy that you've restarted it and are coming at it this way. It sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yep. A lot of fun. No doubt about it.
Right on. All right, Scott, we've kept you, I think, over time. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today.
So this isn't going to be a video where I can show off all my little cool things I brought for some.
We can take a screenshot of that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
We'll do that.
Hey. Oh,
check it out.
Max Payne. You don't have any games that are the name lately. Did you change your formula some? Or do you have some?
Brett and Fred, I mean, the thing is, you know, we find these games that are already named. So, you know, we kind of have to stick. So when I found Turbo Overkill, I asked Sam, the developer who lives in New Zealand, I said, what does that name mean exactly? You know, give me the backstory on that. And he said, just sounds cool. And I said, well, we're going to do more than that. And so we ended up naming the main character in the game, Johnny Turbo. So,
okay. That's fair. Yeah. No. That's very 90s.
All right.
Very 90s.
Yep. Love it.
Turbo Overkill. The name's Turbo.
All right, Scott. Thank you so much. We'll see you around.
Scott. Cheers.
Isn't it awesome that he is still going, still grinding at it, and has found yet again an angle, an approach, you know, with the kinds of games that he's publishing. You know, it's kind of daunting to think about starting a new publisher in this climate where, you know, the big blockbuster games are so expensive and so capital intensive, but he's kind of figured a really awesome place to operate.
Yeah. And they're kind of still doing the shareware stuff, but it's a little different now, right? Now it's the, what is it called? Early access. I just got Wizardum. And early access, and they have like an editor and stuff, and following them on Twitter. And that one's more like, it's not like I guess it is a boomer shooter, right? But it's not like it's not 3D, it's like Doom, you know, that kind of style. Pixel art, but in 3D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's pretty cool. And someone rebuilt the first level of Duke Nukem in it, which is insane. Yeah, I saw it on Twitter.
Using the editor?
Yeah, using their editor, which is really cool.
Yeah. That's cool. I've been, this is neither here nor there, I guess, but I upgraded my ChatGPT to ChatGPT-4, which I'm pretty late to the party. It's been out for a long time.
How long has it been? What's a long time?
I don't know. It's like a year. It's been out for a while.
4 has been out for a year?
Yeah.
Wow. I guess that is
I don't know if exactly a year. You're asking the wrong guy about dates. I'm sorry. In any case,
I'm not trying to put you on this.
You can
ask ChatGPT when it was born.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Yeah, sorry. That's probably a good idea. But you can kind of back and forth. Like, you have it make a picture, and you can be like, "Oh, could you make it more like this? Can you make it more like that?" And it's a little creepy.
It's very funny. I saw a thread for kittens. It was like cute kitten opening a present or something, and then it's like cuter, make it cuter. Yes, yes.
More gift, more cuter,
more cuter, more cuter. It just
those trying. Threads are kind of funny. Yeah,
they are. It's like a meme-y thread. Yeah. Do you think that these that the AI stuff will get to the point where it can do things like this, like with the boomer shooter stuff? Like you could just say, "Make me a game in the style of Quake, set in Egypt. The artistic style is from people from Germany circa 1985. You know, and like you can give it these bullet points.
Yes.
And then it'll like, it'll get, you think it's going to be there. So the holodeck is like right around the corner, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like
it's right.
You plug that thing you just described into the Apple Vision Pro. Yeah.
And then you could play it. Like we're right there. It's going to happen before the end of the year.
Why probably. Would you ever leave
before the end of the century or the end of the decade? Golly, I don't know anything. What? What did you say? Sorry, I was having a conversation.
I said, why would you ever leave the house?
Why do I ever leave the house now? I told you. Since I work from home, right? You know what I do? I go to the grocery store to buy beer. That's my like leaving the house. And I told my wife, I'm like, I'm going to start going to have breakfast by myself at my favorite breakfast place. So I feel like a human because I'm just in my office all day. I wake up and I walk in. I'm in the Matrix, dude. Like, look at my office. It's like, who wouldn't want to, like, I kind of wish I was, like, I would get grounded. And they'd like, go to your room. I'm like, all right. Like, this place is so awesome. Like, this is the coolest place. Like, look at all these toys. Anyways, yeah, I got to get out more, man. And yeah. And when I saw
that. Don't you go out for a walk? You go out and walk around the neighborhood, right?
Now, there's snakes out there, dude. It's
you showed me that kidding. Picture of the snake. Oh, that's it's freaking terrifying.
Which one?
Can you please describe? Do you remember the picture you sent me?
It was a video of a coral snake. Well, I was on a walk. Yeah. And my cat kills snakes and brings snakes to us every once in a while. It's like,
was that actually a poisonous coral snake
in the video? It is. Yeah, their mouth is really little though, and they rarely bite people. Okay. But it is it's the one of the most poisonous. And then we have the worst ones are the baby diamondbacks. Those are the most dangerous. Because they
can't regulate their venom, right?
Yeah, so they'll just go
give it their all.
Everything. Yeah, yeah. And then you just die. And they come, the babies come to our porch because we have lights on sometimes, and then those bring big mosquitoes, and they eat the big mosquitoes. Or they eat the little frogs that come eat the mosquitoes. It's a whole ecosystem, you know?
Good Lord.
But anyways, I don't go for walks because I don't want to go outside, Alex. It's because I'm on California time and the sun goes down now at like 4:30 and I don't want to walk in the dark because there's no lights out there. It's like straight up darkness and there's snakes and boars.
Hey, that reminds me, I've been meaning to tell you about this book that I've been reading. I don't know if you've heard of, do you know who Octavia Butler is? Author
No.
from, I think she wrote in the, she wrote in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Laura recommended this book, Parable of the Sower. Have you heard of it? Parable of the Sower. It's kind of post-apocalyptic.
No, I've never. It sounds familiar.
It's a recommend for me. But you were talking about, you know, wanting to go out walking around after dark.
Parable of the Sower. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
You know, and another recommendation is Bolt Gun. If you want a good boomer shooter. Bolt Gun, and obviously all the ones by Apogee, you know, but Bolt Gun is my recommendation too. The game is awesome.
All right. So for those of you that would like to go the literary route, pick up Parable of the Sower, and we can have a little book club later. And for those of you that want to get your game on.
No audiobooks.
This sounds like an ad. I don't know why.
We're sponsored by.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us for another week of The Fourth Curtain. Hope you enjoyed our conversation with Scott Miller.
Yeah.
And we shall see you next time.
Great stuff. See you all later.
Thank you for listening to The Fourth Curtain Podcast. The Fourth Curtain is a production of Fourth Curtain Media with community management by Doug Zartman. Lovingly edited and mastered by Brian Hensley at Noise Floor Sound Solutions in Chicago. To get a peek at upcoming episodes or to send in questions to the show, visit our site at thefourthcurtain.com. And be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening.